Scripture for this evening will be Revelations 12, 1 through 9. Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and her head a garland of 12 stars. Then, being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. Another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. She bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and his throne. Then the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, the serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him.
I have never been in the military, but I was in the Air Force, so fairly close. Just preacher's job is to speak the truth, right? So I know that battle plans do exist in the military. When armies go to war, they look to what their enemies are going to do or what they think their enemies are going to do, and they come up with a battle plan. That battle plan includes defensive measures. Coaches in any sport, they scout out the other team, sometimes in person, most of the time through some sort of film study. They're looking for their opponent's strengths and weaknesses as athletes. They're looking at the various schemes that their opponent's going to use to try to put points upon the board. So they come up with a defense to suit that particular style of offense that they will be battling against. I'm sure it even happens in the business world when the marketing people are deciding, how do we attack the competition? The competition in turn responds in a offense is the best defense sort of thing. So each one of those, there's a defense of some sort involved. Every last one of us have someone who is out to attack us at all times. That scripture reading that you heard tonight from Revelation chapter 12, while largely symbolic, it well describes Satan and the evil that he is. He's pictured there as this red dragon. He's there to make war. He's there to make war with the church. In fact, later on in the book of Revelation, chapter 17, at the end of chapter 17, it says that he is there to make war with those who hold to the testimony of Jesus. So that would be the church, you and I. So we have someone who is always after us, trying to attack us. Although it becomes rather easy to forget that he is always after us in his own ways and in his own methods. So tonight we're going to take a little bit of time to just think about our enemies, the enemy's method of attack. And really, it's multifaceted. But before we look at those particulars, I want you to think just for a moment about who he is. His name, Satan. He goes by a few different titles, but the name given to him in scriptures is Satan. It is a word that means adversary. That is found both in the New and Old Testaments. So your Hebrew word, your Greek word are both words that mean the adversary. He has made his entire existence strictly about being God's opponent and your opponent and my opponent. The adversary is one who provides adversity. And adversity is misfortune and difficulty. You hear that word used a lot in the sports world. Coaches get lazy and they say, well, yeah, we had to face some adversity today. Oh, you mean like the other team trying to stop you? That's what they're supposed to do. Satan is there to stop you. He is there to provide adversity to you. But these coaches sometimes act as if adversity is this thing that just fell out of nowhere. And it's not supposed to be there. But it is there, and Satan is there, and he's going to make his disdain for you and I, or because of his disdain for you and I, he is there to steal our souls. He's against all that is right. He is against God. He's against all of humanity. He is not powerless by any means. certainly not as powerful as God. Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil. That's in 1 John 3:8. But he is still very powerful. He's got you and I beaten, that's for sure. Paul referred to him as the prince of the power of the air in Ephesians 2:2. In Matthew 25:41, Jesus said hell is reserved for the devil and his angels. So that is indicative that there are spiritual beings that are his followers and his minions, since they are his angels. You look at the book of Job. Look at all that Satan did to Job. He was permitted to do it by God, but he had the power to enact all that hardship that he inflicted upon Job. So he is our enemy, he is our adversary, and he is here to attack us. So let's look at now how Satan likes to attack. Satan attacks by deceit. Deceit, and the other items that we'll see tonight, it works its way into everything. So deceit is always his starting point, because deceit is the opposite of truth. Deceit is to misrepresent the truth, and as we'll see here in a moment, you don't even have to totally abandon truth for deceit to happen. You can just depart from it just a little bit. All you need to do is, you don't have to completely fabricate a whole other story for something to be untrue. All you got to do is mess with truth just a little bit. And again, that always plays a role in how Satan attacks, that being deceit. That was first demonstrated in the Garden of Eden. But before we go and read that account, so let's read something from John here. Jesus was once again at odds with some people. And he said to them, "You are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. Whenever he speaks from his own nature, for he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I speak truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I speak truth, why do you not believe me?" Now, Jesus said that Satan was a murderer from the beginning. And I want you to listen to Genesis chapter 3, where this murder took place at. Genesis chapter 3, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 5. "Now, the serpent was more crafty than any of the beasts of the field which the Lord had made." One of the reasons, I'm going to pause here, one of the reasons that scripture reading tonight came out of Revelation is because that identifies the serpent biblically as Satan. "And he said to the woman, 'Indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden?' The woman said to the serpent, 'From the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat. But from the fruit of the tree, which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, or you will die.' The serpent said to the woman, 'You surely will not die. For God knows that in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" When you look at what Satan said there, "you surely will not die," physically, in that moment, they did not fall over dead. Spiritually, they died. They were as dead as anyone could be. God said, "Do not do," and they did. So when Jesus said he was a murderer from the beginning, that is what he is talking about. Spiritually, they were as dead as could be. And notice that Satan didn't have to say a whole lot to misrepresent truth. All he did was put, "Well, you shall not die." He just said, "You'll know good from evil." And you know what? They did know from good from evil in that moment when they ate of that fruit. Because a lot of what he said, they were actually true words. He just twisted it. He said, "They shall not die." You don't need a whole lot of deceit to cause a great deal of damage. Phrased another way in 1 Corinthians 5:6, and we're going to look at 1 Corinthians 5 a little bit later on. Paul said a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. So all you need is a little bit of leaven to get in there. If you're trying to make something without leaven, the moment there's just a little bit of leaven in there, that whole thing's leavened then. So Satan doesn't need a lot of words sometimes to do his damage. He also presented words that were somewhat true, because they did know good from evil, but he presented words that were true with completely evil motives. They knew good from evil after that. All he needed to do was give them enough words to mess with them just a little bit. See, deception is the complete opposition to truth. And in John 1:17, Jesus is described like this: for the law came through Moses, grace and truth were realized through Jesus. Now you compare that to the description of Satan in John 8:44. He is the father of lies, and he has been a murderer from the beginning. Jesus is truth. Satan is completely incapable of truth. There's responsibility then that this places upon us as we're looking at how does he attack through deceit. This means then that we've got to be people that accept and acknowledge truth, even when that's uncomfortable. We've got a people that accept and acknowledge truth when we have been deceived, even if, and especially if, we've even been the ones to deceive ourselves. You see, the fault of those in John 8:44 through 46 was they did not believe in Jesus as the Son of God. You're in a church building on a Sunday night, so I don't think your issue is believing in Jesus as the Son of God. But what might be your particular issue? That's not going to be the same for all of us when it comes to being deceived, because we're not immune to deceit. So deception always plays a role. So let's look at one of his more specific methods then. And this is found in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 12 through 15. And what we're going to see here is disguise. We're going to look at disguise. A running theme through 2 Corinthians was Paul having to defend his apostleship. There were people that took, I guess, supposedly some things that he said in 1 Corinthians, and they decided to attack him and deny his credibility and deny who he was. And so part of what he had to do in 2 Corinthians was straighten that out some. And he addresses that heavily in chapter 11, because it's a good method of attack to say this guy's not a real apostle, because there were indeed false teachers running around from the very early days of the church. And so here's what Paul wrote to the church in 2 Corinthians 11, verses 12 through 15. But what I am doing, I will continue to do so that I may not cut off the opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the manner about which they are boasting. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. No wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it is not surprising if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness, whose end will be according to their deeds. So false workers disguise themselves, Paul said, and they do that just as their master does. Disguise is necessary. Sin presented itself as it really and truly was. If you knew all the consequences of it, you wouldn't accept it. You wouldn't want any part of it. So disguise is necessary. It has to be made appealing in some way. If you ever look at warning labels of anything, warning labels and warning signs, and kind of as a side note, if you ever really read some of those sometimes, it's amazing what they have to warn people about. And you know that they're warning people because somebody done that dumb thing that you're reading about on the warning label. Or they know somebody's going to do it. But warning labels exist to provide caution, to keep you safe. But again, sin doesn't present itself that way. Sin doesn't come up with a warning label. It comes up with a disguise. And the people that promote sin come up with a disguise. Evil is often presented as pleasure. Cookies taste better than broccoli. That's a fact. I'm not trying to skate anything by you right there. Cookies taste better than broccoli. That is a fact. Cookies are not good for you. Broccoli is. But when you eat each one, there's no way that you would think the cookie is bad, because it tastes good and it's fun to eat. But the thing that's good for you, in this case broccoli, it feels like a punishment when you eat it, but it's good for you. How can something, though, so pleasurable be so bad? The cookie doesn't advertise it's dangerous to you. When I eat broccoli, I don't want any more. When I eat cookies, I want more. And not just one. That cookie's not going to do any favors for my teeth and my gums. Ingesting all that sugar into my system's not going to do any good as well, too. It's going to deter you from wanting healthier food, because, again, healthy food tastes like garbage. And so you want to eat what tastes good, what is pleasurable to you. The broccoli, on the other hand, it's good for you. It's good for you. But when you think about it logically, if you knew all the damage that eating a bunch of cookies could do to you versus eating broccoli, there's no way in your right mind that you would say, yeah, I'm going to choose the cookies knowing the danger. See, if we knew all the danger of sin, we would never in our right mind choose it on purpose. But sin is disguised. Now, as a side point, since I'm talking about cookies, you people that are trying to make cookies healthy, y'all just stop it. Because that's not food either. If you want to eat healthy, eat the cookies in moderation. Don't mess with them. Leave them alone. I'm using this as a comparison. I'm not saying you can't eat cookies. I'm just saying do it the right way. Don't make them healthy. Just leave it alone. We don't need any of that. What are the disguises that you see put on sin? A few years ago, I decided I was going to try this workout program because a few years ago, I wasn't the stud that I am now, so I decided I needed to work out. I don't remember. That's not a joke. Y'all are laughing. I don't remember what the name of it was. It was the fad at the time. The commercials were on TV a whole bunch. And what I did was I borrowed the DVD from somebody that had this, and I'm trying to do this workout in my garage, watching it on a little laptop. And it's like all those other useless workout fads. There's like 20 people on the screen all doing the same thing, okay? And I think about the intent of what they at least advertise. They're saying, we got you a video or a set of videos, and you're going to do this workout, and you're going to get in good shape. And I don't doubt that it can happen. However, as I'm watching a couple of these, I have to really acknowledge what I'm looking at. I go, you know, these people ain't wearing a lot of clothes. You know, the dudes on there, that ain't so much a problem. The women on there, that's a problem. And at first I tell myself, well, its intent is for exercise, to get me in good shape. But I had to just accept the fact that, you know what, its intent is to sell videos. They could care less how good a shape you get into as long as they're selling videos. What sells? People not wearing a lot of clothes. It's a disguise. We say, here's something that's useful. Maybe it is. But you know what? You don't need 20 people up there showing you how to do the same exercise. One dude in clothes could be up there showing me how to do the exercises. I don't need 20 people doing all that. Sin disguises itself. So I put the videos up. You've got to see through the disguise. And I think a lot of times if we really look at it, if we really think about it, seeing through the disguise of sin isn't that hard. But many times our challenge isn't the inability to sniff sin out in its disguises. It's more so our unwillingness. So we've got to see through the disguise of sin. Now, when you see through the disguise of sin, that doesn't mean that Satan's done. All that means is he's going to attack you another way. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, one of the best known verses about Satan. Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. The way that lions hunt is rather fascinating. And this is probably one of the reasons why it's such a good illustration. Is because, again, sin doesn't come up and say, I'm here to eat you. Lions sneak up on their prey. If they've got tall grass, they creep through the tall grass. If they don't have tall grass, they stay low to the ground. They move slow. They wait till that animal that they're trying to sucker out isn't paying attention. If they're going after a herd, they don't just run up into the midst of the herd and hope they catch someone. They look to see who's behind, who's weak, who will be the easiest to catch. They're very smart in how they hunt. And they're there to kill and they're there to eat. They're there to devour. If somebody followed you around all the time with a weapon, just waiting for you to mess up to where you're not paying them any attention, and then they got you, you'd pay very careful attention to everything you did every day at all times. But that is exactly what we have going on. No, he's not physically right there, right beside us, waiting to stab us, waiting to shoot us, waiting to physically harm us in some way. But Satan, the best that he can, he's not God, he can't be everywhere at all times, but however it is that evil influences work in this world, they are there and they are waiting for you and they are setting traps. They're following us around all the time. But Peter tells us not only the threat, but he tells us the prevention. He says, be of sober spirit. First of all, that just means to be calm. Now, if you're in a threatening situation, you have to be calm. It's always the panicking people that, at least in the movies, for whatever that's worth, it's always the panicking people that get it. And no one's ever calmed down just because someone said, be calm. But Peter's telling you, first of all, be calm. Be calm, because don't be surprised that Satan's after you. Again, he is the adversary. He is there to provide adversity. He's made it his business. So he's going to be there. He says, be on the alert. That means watch, give attention to. In ancient times, when cities had walls built around them, they had watchmen on those city walls, and they were watching for an enemy. There was someone on those walls at all times. If they saw the enemy, they weren't surprised, because that's what they were there for. They were there to watch. And they say, there's the enemy, and then they warn. And then people could get ready to defend. We have to keep our guard up. We got to keep our guard up all the time, because you never know when it's going to strike. I talked to a friend today, and we were talking about the use of cell phones, especially by children. He's in a Bible class, and he says, I want you to define the word obscene. So instead of thinking about it, someone pulls out their phone and starts to Google, what is obscene? Well, when you Google things, Google thinks it knows everything. So not only does it give you words, it gives you pictures. Well, obscene pictures came up on the phone in the Bible class. And just like that, just that fast, there's the evil. There it is. Always have to be on guard. You can't ever shrug off sin, because if you shrug off sin, you're going to be more open to attack, and you're going to be open to another method of attack. And that other method of attack is Satan will want to desensitize you. He will want to desensitize you. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Here's what Paul wrote. It is actually reported that there is immorality among you, an immorality of such a kind as does not exist even among the Gentiles, that someone has his father's wife. You have become arrogant and have not mourned instead, so that the one who had done this deed would be removed from your midst. Paul is warning against just being rather meh about sin. We get used to it. We get desensitized to it. It happens around us so much that we forget how bad it is. We forget how terrible it is. We forget how much God hates it. We forget that Jesus died to forgive us of it. And you look at that case in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and you think, wow, that's an extreme case. I would hope nothing like that would ever happen in the church. It happened in the church. Paul wrote about it in 1 Corinthians 5. I mean, something that terrible. He says it's so bad that the people outside of the church, and when a person, especially a Jew, heard the word Gentiles, they're just thinking heathen, bad, filth. And he says, so amongst the Gentiles, so people that are outside of Christ, like, we haven't even found anything that horrible out there. Again, as kind of a side note, something that's comforting about all that, Paul started that letter and said, to the saints at Corinth. So despite all their faults and all their flaws, God was still willing to claim them, but he needs to let them know, there's things you got to get straightened out. Now, he wasn't willing to claim this person, because Paul says, this has to go. He said, you guys didn't mourn about it. You got arrogant about it and you boasted about it. But he said, instead of that, there should have been clear, decisive action. Instead, there was I'm about to mispronounce the word. They got desensitized to it instead. When you look at some of the moral issues in our nation, it's probably only a matter of time till you see it on a wider scale, because I could tell you of some places where such things have already happened, where the idea that in the Church of Christ, places that say we are the Church of Christ, that there will be an acceptance into what is essentially the membership of congregations of people who are unrepentant sinners. And people say, well, we need to welcome them in. We need to help them. We need to teach them Jesus. But to say that somebody who has not obeyed the gospel is a part of the church, we can't do it. Especially people that are living openly sinful lives. And as things go on, it won't even just be people outside. Well, we'll get folks who have said, well, I am a Christian, I'm obeying the gospel, but I'm going to live a decidedly immoral life. And it will be accepted. It's happening. It will happen on a larger scale. Because as much as it should not happen, the reality is culture impacts us. Culture influences us when we let it. It doesn't have to, but if we let it, it will indeed happen. And that happens because, again, we are desensitized to sin. You know, what used to be clear sin, even by, you know, worldly standards, in a society like ours where there used to be a lot more Bible-based morality amongst just the general population, that's certainly slid over the last several years. But even amongst the world, when you look a long time ago, when people went to the beach, how do they dress? Or how do they dress? Well, they still had a lot of clothes. You go to the beach now, and people are in their underwear. Now, people don't walk around town like that. Well, why not? Well, it's not acceptable to walk around town like that, but it's acceptable to go to the beach in your underwear. Do we accept that just because society does? Or we get desensitized and say, well, it's okay for me to do that because it's acceptable there. Well, who deemed it acceptable? Not God. Some person did. The world creeps its way into the church. The world will always lower its standard. And I know that happens in every single generation. And I'll tell you this, in hindsight now, as a child, I think back to some of the things I watched as a child. Y'all remember the TV show Friends? It was funny for like 2 seasons. But a lot of the stuff that show, at least to my generation, introduced and made normal, you know, homosexual, not just relationships, but families, you know, fornication, the idea that you don't even need family, just as you've got other people around you that love you, that's good if it's the church, but if it's people that aren't the church, and they're telling you, and you live however you want to live, by no standard that's God's, that's not a good thing. And Friends wasn't the first show to do things like that. I'm just telling you from an experience I had as a child, that show brought in a lot of things that, if I wasn't paying attention to it, and if other people my age weren't paying attention to it, maybe there wouldn't be the same influence that there is today. But here's what's the worst thing about all that. I didn't find out about Friends by looking through a TV guide. I heard about it from people at church because they were watching it. And then I started watching it. That's not the type of influence that the church should have upon one another. We can't lower our standards. And when we don't lower our standards, we're going to be made to be the bad guy. We have to be okay with being the bad guy. We have to be willing to say, I don't care about that. I can't be meh about it. If the world wants to say we're the bad guy, fine. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5, that has no place. You get it out. If there's not going to be repentance, you get it out. So when things like that happen, you kind of just have to say, if somebody doesn't like it, I don't care. You and I cannot accept what God will not accept. We're not here to start fights. We're not here to hurt feelings. But we're also not here to be influenced and desensitized by those who care nothing for the Lord and His standards. Bad company corrupts good morals. 1 Corinthians 15:33. It happens. It's a thing. So bad company is not to influence us. Bad company is not to have access to the children that we own or been given by God to raise and turn back over to Him. It has no place in the church. And when the church recognizes that and when the church acts upon that, we don't owe anybody an apology. We don't owe people an apology when they don't conform to God's standards because we can't shrug off God's sin or we can't shrug off sin. So we have to keep in mind, Satan is always there. He is always willing to attack. He doesn't take off days. He doesn't need off days. So you and I can't take an off day. If we take an off day, if we think we've arrived somehow, if we think we're okay, if we think there's nothing that we're struggling with, well, he's got you then. He's always after you. He's got lots of methods of attack. Deceit finds its way into everything. Tonight, if you've been susceptible to his attack throughout your entire life, if he still has your soul, I want you to consider what it is to not belong to him anymore. The blessings, the benefits, the privileges that it is to become a Christian and be free of Satan. be free of Satan, become a slave of Jesus. When you hear the word slave, that may not sound like anything good. That is absolutely what you want in the case of belonging to Jesus. Because as Romans tells us, you're a slave of sin or you're a slave of righteousness. You're a slave of somebody. Be a slave of Jesus. If you made the decision to be a slave of Jesus, but perhaps tonight you've recognized, you know, Satan's, you know, he's gotten me. He's tricked me. I've bought in. I want some help getting back out, away from his clutches, back into the good graces of God and his church. If you want any help, come forward as we stand and sing.